Evolving Cloud Architecture with Jeff Fritz.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. This podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company empowering .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. And by the way, any company needing fractional software leadership or a fractional architect, go ahead and give ClearMeasure a call. They help in-house software teams to move fast and get the quality where it needs to be and improve production stability. And if you do have a comment or question for the show, then send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And also, my new online TV show launched quite a while ago. You can search for, quote, Programming with Palermo in any of the podcast directories, and you'll be able to find it on www.palermo.network as well. I have a repeat guest back on the show, Jeff Fritz. Jeff Fritz is back here on the podcast, and he's an experienced developer, technical educator, and program manager on the .NET team at Microsoft. And he founded the Live Coders team on Twitch and regularly live streams builds of websites and fun applications. And you can follow Jeff for more .NET and .NET Core and Visual Studio content on Twitch and Twitter at C#Fritz. That's at C-S-H-A-R-P-F-R-I-T-Z. Jeff, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
Oh, it's good to be back. Gosh, it's been a busy few months here this fall. My goodness, lots changing, lots happening in the .NET ecosystem, huh?
Oh, well, absolutely. I want to get into that. And there's lots of people who kind of follow you and whatnot. But for the people out there who maybe are getting to know you for the first time, give us some runways. What are the high points that are kind of put you into what you're working on now?
I've been a longtime web developer. I'm one of the survivors of, right, the .com bomb, right? It helped a couple companies build big websites, multi-tenant websites, was recruited and worked for Telerik, now Progress Software, as a developer advocate, teaching folks how to use ASP.NET, web application development tools, and started at Microsoft, helping out building NuGet, helping present content at various events, and then presenting events. And the past few years, I've been working on .NET Conf, and starting this year, I'm now the producer of .NET Conf. So that's been a big step up for me to now be the leader and manage and deliver a conference. Big evolution. And like you mentioned, I don't want to just be that program manager, that person who's giving direction around the product, but I do keep my hands dirty. I do keep my feet wet by writing code, teaching, and streaming regularly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of .NET Conf, there's just at the time of recording just a couple of weeks ago, .NET 7 came out, but some other really big announcements. What were the ones that kind of you and the team were most excited about internally?
Well, .NET 7 was a big update for performance, to help make things easier to develop for building those native cloud applications. So the big things that we were able to share around the performance gains around our various Microsoft applications that use .NET 7 now. Huge, huge updates, big performance improvements, being able to show and share exactly how much folks are able to get out of that, but by doing nothing more than just changing the version numbers in their application. That was a fantastic element for us to share. Performance updates coming for .NET MAUI, big enhancements coming for Blazor that make applications smaller, faster, and now being able to build custom HTML elements with Blazor, reference those in other JavaScript applications, HTML applications. Those were big for us because it meant you don't have to carry around the entire .NET framework. You don't have to use all of the rendering and features of Blazor if you want to get .NET in your browser. So I think that's important because that allows us to cross that divide where folks say, gosh, it takes so long for Blazor to start up. Well, fine. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to use all of Blazor, but you have some code, you have some things that are optimized for you over there, go ahead and continue using React, Vue, Angular, Vanilla.js, and call into Blazor and .NET when you need that additional power. I think that was a big step to show just how much Blazor can impact not just the .NET ecosystem, but everybody that builds web applications. They can take advantage of how easily they can reach into and work with .NET in their applications, their web applications. Great stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I'm guessing you're going to use some of those new features in your ClipTalk application. You mentioned that last time you were on the show.
I'm moving there. There's some definitely some things there that I need to consider. The application has been growing. We're about 2 years into it at this point. It's only me. A couple of folks have volunteered to help out and chip in here and there that build it. And I've hit some bumps in the road growth-wise. So just upgrading to .NET 7 and seeing that performance improvement is huge for the APIs and the functions that run that support it. And it, of course, getting the Blazor WebAssembly content of the application, getting that smaller and faster, multi-threaded running in the browser, fantastic opportunities for that application to grow and become easier for folks to use. But I've run into, gosh, Jeff, that problem of I've outgrown just the basic stuff that you do when you build an application, right? The basic things that you learn and see and you do inside all the demos. But I'm into phase three of the architecture where I've grown beyond just, hey, it's an API that I run standard CRUD operations against. All right, well, now I need to start setting up some queuing. Mm-hmm. Now I need to set up a service bus. I've got GitHub Actions set up to deploy and manage the state of things. I've got GitHub Actions that deploy configuration entries, monitoring systems set up using tools like Datadog. Now what?
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your first go? So you got, you know, Microsoft Learn samples and all that stuff. And so how did it start out? What were the initial decisions that you made?
I initially thought, you know what, let's take as much of this content. Now, just to recap, ClipTalk makes Twitch clips searchable, discoverable on the web. That's all it does. You log in with your Twitch account, and you're able to find other Twitch clips, get caught up on the highlights of other streams that have happened on Twitch. That's the goal.
All right. So it's around Twitch. It has nothing to do with TikTok. It's about Twitch.
No. It feels like TikTok in that it's got that same type of, here, I'm just going to present videos to you and you can scroll through them.
Okay.
So my initial thought was, well, we can make all the pages that host video clips, just make them static HTML, just write them out to disk. Mm. Here it is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I'm going to host this with Blazor, I can actually just put these down as JSON blobs, store them into Azure Blob Storage. Mm-hmm. And when you navigate around, all I'm doing is just grabbing a static file out of Blob Storage and just rendering that JSON. That's quick and easy. What I quickly found out is those files are static, but when you're constantly writing new files, and you're writing millions of new files, you hit a cost boundary and you hit a latency boundary with Azure Storage, right? Azure Storage wants to be write infrequently, read frequently.
Yeah.
Right. And writing all those JSON files as things change and putting that content out on disk became cost prohibitive. Right? You see that first bill come in for $100 to run storage. And it's like, wait a sec, what the heck am I doing that it cost me $100 for storage? Because it's pennies to have thousands of requests.
Right.
And I'm paying $100. What's going on? And I look at the request and it's like, oh.
Well, that's a good point. For a production application you're making money on, okay, that's probably not so much. But you're at the scale still where this is a This is an individual project application, not scaled to a bunch of customers. And for example, there's lots of developers that use the credits that come with the VS Enterprise, the you know, $150-$200 a month. And if you use it all up on just storage, then what else can you do?
Between app service and storage, there's my $150 a month. So how do I move this around? How do I start putting that somewhere that's a little bit easier to use? So I looked at Azure Table Storage. Too simple. Like, it wasn't complex enough for the type of searching that I needed to do. So I said, well, I know relational database. I can run a MySQL database for $20-$30 a month. I'm not charged on the number of requests. Let's put it over there. And then let's get rid of app service and go to an Azure Static app, right?
Okay.
Go to a static web app. I'm not paying anything then for the hosting of that because it's Blazor WebAssembly. So I've reduced my application cost. By eliminating app service and going to a static web app, I've eliminated my blob storage cost by putting everything into a database and fine, I'll load it from the database with an API, do some caching on it, and we're good. Funny thing happens with Azure Functions and relational databases. So when you stand up Azure Functions, right, and you have a consumption plan, Azure will scale out a number of instances for the amount of work that it needs to finish. So if it's scaling out numbers of instances and you have entity framework reaching into a relational database like MySQL or Postgres or SQL Server, it scales out the number of those connections also. So suddenly when I would get pressure, it would have a dozen instances of Functions apps, and each one of those would have 20 to 50 connections in the pool.
It's like a vicious cycle.
I was DDoSing my own database.
Made you go for MySQL instead of the serverless Azure SQL?
Cost.
Okay. So my memory, well, not the serverless, but the DTU one, I think the basic is $5. The next step up is what, $15 a month?
So what's a DTU?
Sure. No, nobody can give you the answer, but whatever. At the five level versus the 10, the 20, the up level.
Sure. But I don't know how many DTUs I'm using because I don't know what a DTU is. I don't know how to manage, how to measure my application so I can manage the amount of DTUs that I'm using. So to have an unbounded cost there and not an estimate of that as I'm into phase two of the growth of this application, it was like,
does MySQL give you? I'm not familiar with the levers that the Azure MySQL gives you.
Couple processors and RAM.
Okay, so you have to choose the upper bound.
Yeah, you dictate how many processors, how much RAM you want.
Okay, that's my experience with DTU. It's the upper bound. It doesn't auto scale, but it's just kind of the upper bound. But you're right. I don't know exactly how many processors that is.
And if I buy 10 DTUs, I don't know what happens when I need an 11th.
Yeah, I think from my memory, 100 DTUs. Might be close to a dedicated vCPU.
I don't know.
But yeah. Okay. So what'd you do next?
So, all right. It started scaling back. Found the levers inside Azure Functions to say, you know what? We only need two or three of these things. We don't need you to scale out to a dozen of them. So pulled that back. The next step was, I want to put search into this. Well, Azure Cognitive Search is a fantastic tool to use. 50 meg of search that you can set up and use for free. Yes, I can do that. I'm searching through a couple thousand channel names, no big deal. But when you outgrow that, you get to a 2 gig limit and it costs $7,500 a month. Okay, we can do that. And that's not too bad. But now I'm looking at $200 a month to run my little website and no customers. Like, I can take that investment. That's not bad. We're working with this. And the challenge then becomes looking at, well, what does my runway look like? How do I grow? How do I change this? What are the services that I want to use so that I can minimize cost and still continue to grow the application? And in the case of an application like this, where I've always got new data arriving every day.
Yeah.
It's tricky. The technology that we're using is secondary to the budget for the technology that mm-hmm. we're using.
Yep.
How do we manage that? And it's something that's not entirely clear as we get into some of the services, some of the tools, some of the technologies that we're using. So I think that's something that we as an industry, as folks that are consulting, recommending to customers, we need to figure out a good way to strike that balance. And when I look at the demos that are available for folks out there, there's the basic demo for technology X mm-hmm. that we have, right? The training materials. Hey, get started with Foo, mm-hmm. Foo.net, Azure Foo service on steroids, whatever it is.
Yep.
And right, there's the basic, here it is, get started. What's the second demo? Great, you've outgrown, you figured out how to do, get running on Foo, using technology mm-hmm. Foo. What's demo number two?
Yeah.
What's demo number three? At some point down the line, we're all going to end up on Kubernetes clusters with Grafana monitoring and all the things happening and fantastic dashboards. And it's an amazing ecosystem. But what's first? What's second? And I think that's something that in my experience going through, and gosh, I've moved off of MySQL and gone into several different technologies since, but what do those steps look like? And I feel like for us as educators, for us as a technical community, I feel like we don't emphasize the path, the journey to that. We're either talking to enterprise customers or we're talking to folks that are just getting started. What's the journey look like in between? Mm-hmm. Great, you finished the basics. And in my case, I've been trying to bring in caching appliances. How do I cache things? I can cache a couple hundred K in memory pretty easily. Well, what happens when I need to cache megabytes?
Right.
Gigabytes. I've got a database right now that has 20 gig of data stored, replicated on 3 nodes in a cluster, but the indexes to cache and allow me to search them are another 85 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't feel right. That feels weird.
So you've got a great question. Have you come up with an answer?
No, not yet. These are the challenges that there really isn't a playbook out there, right? It's how do we glue these things together? And not just how do we put these things together, but how do we put them together in a cost-effective way? Redis is a fantastic solution. It's a little bit expensive to run Redis for a month.
Yeah.
$100 or so. Like,
you've got a side project that you've been going at for a couple of years. And for those, you know, you do have a journey that's lasted a couple hundred years. I'm wondering though, the duration of the journey from first line of code to the enterprise patterns. And it feels like it's a much shorter period of time than our side projects. Because they've got to get this going into production, and then they hit the real problems a lot quicker.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
You used a really good phrase there that I want to go back to, enterprise patterns.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not using complete enterprise architecture, but there's definitely patterns there that I'm into, queuing, service bus, right? Messaging patterns, pub sub capabilities, and sending managing dead letter queues, these types of things that you don't get into in those first couple rounds of demos and things that folks look at, right? I feel like, yeah, the journey there through those patterns is one thing, because you can do those patterns for cheap, right? They're easy to set up. I mean, Azure Service Bus, you can get, I think it's 1 million transactions for free. I forget what there's an initial set. It's either 100,000 or 1 million transactions you get for free to start. And it's like, for someone starting out, that's pretty good.
Yeah, lots of messages.
But what's next?
Yeah, right.
How do you manage that? How do you stand that up and knock it down and move it around? And what's the portability? And these are questions that I haven't completely hit yet, but and I know some of the answers for where I want to go, but I feel like as we grow applications, we need to figure out a better way to tell folks this story. And in my journey as an educator and letting folks watch all of this and watch me make mistakes, right? I feel like that's something that we as educators need to do more of, is show folks, hey, here's what happens when you make a mistake.
You mentioned everybody's going to end up on Kubernetes with Grafana. I'm not sure that the average body of .NET developers has a shared vision for where to end up when something is big and complex, because there's a lot of getting started docs, but I don't see a whole lot of finish line demonstrations. Oh, by the way, here's a complete enterprise level environment. Let me just show you around.
So we built a very enterprise model application around this podcast application that you'll find out there. We demoed for .NET Conf last year. We did it a bit over the two focus events. I think it was two we did over the last year. And of course, the one this year we showed right here. It's a website with a mobile application. It's got some cloud services with functions that do these processing, blah, blah, blah. But, and that's great when there's a couple dozen folks using it and you've got 40, 50 podcasts that it's indexing and working with. What happens when the first 100,000 people show up? The first 1 million people show up? How do you scale that? What does that look like? And those operations decisions and architecture shifts and how that jumps up. Those are the things that you're right. We don't have a clear vision that we've taught exactly what that endpoint looks like. And I'm spitballing saying, you know, oh, we're going to end up at Kubernetes. There's definitely, when we get to scale, the need to have that very distributed and manageable architecture. For some applications that might be running inside of in internal corporations, intranet, no, you don't need all that. Yeah, you know what? Running on a server with a couple databases backing it up and a back office service that's doing some behind the scenes processing. Sure, that's probably enough for your needs. It's when we try to get to internet scale. And gosh, I think about, and not to timestamp too much where we are, I think about where the Twitter engineers and operations folks are right now. As their organization here in mid-November is going through so much upheaval, what's it like to maintain that operation? So many servers and databases in that. And you've got knowledge walking out the door right now. How do they maintain that? How do they keep the wheels turning on that? And it's there's going to be two stories that come out of what we're seeing going on with Twitter right now. And one's going to be people management and how that worked. And the other one is going to be operations management and how they kept things going through so much change and upheaval and turmoil in a company as that's going on. I think both are going to be compelling stories for us as technologists. That operations story, I think, is something that we're all going to learn from.
Well, you made a point with your ClipTalk application about the choices. And when it comes to operation, I would wonder, how are we projecting what it's going to take to operate a particular architecture? How many unique concepts do we have up and running that have their own different maintenance tasks just to keep them running. Because it's very different to have a whole bunch of things running around versus a Azure app service with the, you know, visually with the slider bar of, oh, now I just have more of them versus no, I have one of each, but each is different.
Yes. So about a year ago, I consolidated all of my, I had distributed data sources between, between a little bit of blob storage, MySQL, Azure Cognitive Search. I consolidated all that into the RavenDB database. Our friend Ayende Rahin, or an Eni, and his company manage that. And fantastic database. But as it scales, as it changes, it wants to rebuild indexes. Well, when you're writing a lot of data into that database, it's rebuilding indexes all the time.
Yeah.
So now, to your point, I need to forecast. Well, wait a sec. If I'm writing 20 to 30,000 clips a day into the database, how much are those indexes rebuilding, drive spinning? Because I've only got so many IOPS. I've only got so much disk time that's allocated to my servers. So that type of forecasting means, okay, maybe we should move some of this content somewhere else. And how do we store and index content in this database and move some things into another storage mechanism because we need faster access to those things. And maybe we use a little bit of a cache appliance so that then Raven becomes something else. How do we, and it's this, like you're saying, this evolution of distributing things. So it's not just one database, one entity framework connection that's reaching out and querying, and it has a collection of those entities that we're interacting with. It's an interesting growth story.
Well, you give an example of something where, with all of your experience, you know, you and I both started programming in the 90s, but with all of that experience, there's still some things that are not easily forecastable. They're not obvious for what something's going to do at a certain level. And I think that's always going to be that way, where based on experience and different people on the team having seen things before and not, okay, we know where this is going to go, and there's a whole lot of things that fall into that category, but there's always going to be some surprises that even we think it's going to go a certain way, but then we're going to say, oh, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, we're outrunning the index creation or whatever it happens to be. And there's always going to be adjustments. I think that goes to the DevOps kind of principle of go to production on day one.
Yes.
And whether or not you can have paying customers using the application, production is in all forms. Production like infrastructure and whatever cloud provider you're searching for, production like load. I had a customer that ultimately needed to know on day one of school, all the teachers and all the students using something, we're not going to take it down. But a whole lot of work was being done in the spring and in the summer. They didn't have access to whatever that load was. And, and so their service, we grabbed a service that was effectively a load generator. We're like, okay, what are these students and teachers going to do? They're going to log in. Okay, great. We're going to simulate. We use Selenium, you know, to just click through the application and then used a service to generate however many number of students and however many number of teachers we thought we were going to be in the classroom. And then just had that load on it all the time while normal team testing was going on, so they could see how the system actually felt during those times and make that the normal testing instead of the system being at rest while we test.
Yeah, that's a really good approach. And the challenge is, the way I see it, and I'd love to hear your feedback, is how do you weight the database so that some of that test data, right, that is being generated, written, interacted with, can be rolled back? Or is that just running against a staging system that you're looking at?
Oh, well, in that case, it was a different environment. Okay. We've had a lot of luck with Redgate SQL clone and SQL database backups because, and when you're talking about rolling back big test databases, those probably the best products out there for SQL Server. They're aimed at that, but we didn't actually create a weighted database. We let the database get to whatever weighting it was going to be because it had real usage. We thought, what's going to happen in the real world? Do we know how this database is going to end up being weighted? No, we're going to discover that. We're going to find that out. How? Well, we know the features we put in the system. We're going to have to guess how many times a day the students are going to use a feature, the teachers are going to use the feature. And so we weight the number of iterations in the tests as we run them, but then the database ends up big and it ends up whatever it's going to be.
Yep.
And then the assumptions that we have to make are how many times a day per hour is a teacher going to do function ABC, and same thing for students. But we did learn, none of us were right about how the database was going to end up being, how many tables were going to be massive, how many tables are going to be small, things like that.
You see, and that's where I think a tool, a real user monitoring tool, becomes so helpful, because then you can see, here's the sessions, and you can get details about how many times things were going through, and to be able to grab those sessions and be able to say, okay, let's build the Selenium process that runs in our staging environment to rerun this thing, hit these APIs, hit this user interface. That becomes so useful to build up that knowledge of, here's how the site's being used. When I'm in development here and I'm building and querying and running just, hey, let's build a new user interface on top of the existing features that are out there to do read operations, not to do more write operations to the database, but to do more reads, I run against the production database. I'm just reading data. So it doesn't matter how much it actually helps for me to be able to work with live data. And as I went through and was doing some of that, something that I learned and around the behavior, to similarly to your model of teachers working at a school, what I learned about folks that were creating clips on Twitch is, for the larger streamers, for some of the more popular folks, they'll get 10 to 20 duplicates of the exact content throughout their entire stream. So let's say streamer X is out there and they're running their stream and it's a 4-hour stream. They might have 7,000 clips created from that 4-hour stream.
Yeah.
Now, wait a sec. If each clip is 30 seconds, when you do the math, if you put all of those clips, if they're all unique clips, there's more than a day's worth of video that they've identified there. Now, here I am 2 years in, and I'm looking at it, I'm going, there's a lot of duplicate data here. So just like you're saying, I've learned, holy crow, look at how people are really using this thing. Let's not make it so stupid.
Yeah.
Let's not store all of these records. Let's figure out a way to consolidate and better architect our database. And I'm crossing a, let's re-architect the database discussion right now. And it's something that, when I think about lean methods, typically we think about, right, refactoring your code, but refactoring your database architecture, this is one that I haven't done in a very, very long time. And I'm excited and looking forward to what this is going to bring, what I'm going to learn as I start that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And come to think of it, unless I'm looking in the wrong spot, I tend to look at more demos online of compute components of an application rather than data storage components.
Yeah, you're right. Gosh, how can I compute this thing faster? How can I fetch data faster or present something more optimally? And this is a time in a process that it's been a while since I've gone through, and I'm, like I said, I'm excited to do. I can tell right away, I'm going to save a ton of space on my database because I'm going to eliminate how much duplicated data.
Yeah.
So that analysis alone is ridiculous to try and figure out.
Right. Well, as we come to the end of our time here, for people kind of intrigued, how can they watch you as you kind of make those decisions and go through that journey?
You can check me out 3 days a week. You can find me on Twitch, twitch.tv/csharpfritz, C-S-H-A-R-P-F-R-I-T-Z. You can see the website that I'm building. That is cliptok.com, K-L-I-P-T-O-K.com. There's a blog link up at the top there. You can click that. And as I cross a technical boundary, I'll put blog posts up there as things happen to talk through some of the things that we've built. Folks have asked me questions about the suggestions algorithm that we added into it. And it's a block of ML.net. I provide the source code and show people how that works on the blog, just as an example. But as I go through this deduping process, I'm definitely going to be blogging and sharing what I've learned from that along the way. And I need to get it back into the mode of putting together YouTube clips about just a snapshot summary of here's what we figured out, here's what how it works, and here's the outcome. So you can find my YouTube on youtube.com/C#Fritz, spelled the same way.
Nice, nice. All right, we'll make sure to include all those links in the show notes. And man, Jeff, thanks for coming back on the show. It was a great conversation.
Oh my gosh, thank you. And I feel like there's so much that we learn when we talk with each other and other folks in this space. So I really appreciate you having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.